I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer, and now the first installment in our Oscar documentary series, where we're talking about this year's Oscar-nominated feature-length documentaries. First up is Cutie and the Boxer, an intimate film about the relationship of two married artists, Noriko and Ushio Shinohara. Here to tell us about the movie is the director, Zachary Heinzerling. Zachary, congratulations on your nomination, and welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So this film is a deceptively simple story about the long marriage of two artists. First, introduce us to them, for those who haven't seen the film. Who are Ushio Shinohara and Noriko Shinohara as artists?
As artist, Ushio is probably the most well-known of the two. He became famous in the 1960s for being a part of a group called the Neo-Dada Organizers, which was a post-war avant-garde group that did a lot of performance art. And he sort of became most famous for his boxing paintings, which he started in the early 60s by basically just assaulting a canvas with paint-covered hands. And that sort of became what he was known for, and he moved to New York in the late 60s, part of a group of kind of expatriate Japanese artists living in Soho. He was sort of known as this infant terrible, the kind of downtown art scene partier, infamous for his drinking and sort of making a scene everywhere he went. And Noriko came in, when she was 19 years old, met Ushio, fell in love, was in art school, and had to sort of put her artistic aspirations on hold to become the wife and sort of caretaker for Ushio. So the film sort of picks up later in life. Ushio is now 80, Noriko is 60, and their son is now older, and Noriko really has a chance to grow as an artist and to sort of gain her independence from Ushio. And there's a sort of role reversal that happens over the course of the film where she starts to take power in the relationship. Ushio's struggling to sort of find his lasting legacy in a competitive New York art scene, and Noriko is really flourishing as an artist and doing a lot of the things that she wasn't able to while she was raising both her son and her other son, Ushio.
I mean, it's such an intimate portrait of the resentments that gather over the course of a long relationship about who's responsible for managing the household budget, who's responsible for bringing in money, who raises the children. And you see all of this not while it's happening, but after it's accumulated for decades over the course of their marriage. You start early on in the scene, there's a scene where Noriko and Ushio are sitting at the kitchen table, and Noriko is talking about the rent that has to be paid and the utilities that have to be paid, and Ushio is asking her how much money he needs to bring in. And you have another scene that's archival footage of Ushio shifting in a moment from sort of jocular drinking and partying with friends and talking about how the New York Times has called him wonderful as an artist, and then he just breaks down crying. You capture so beautifully the tensions and the pressures of being a working artist and the ways this husband and wife deal with it pretty differently.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a film about creative desire that's so strong that it hurts. And I think I'm fascinated by the kind of life of an artist, and especially with these two artists whose art is really their lives. I mean, with Ushio, his performance is his art. His body is his artwork. You have to see the way that he makes the art and every, blood, sweat, and tear that goes into it for it to be the sort of art that he wants you to see. And I think with Noriko, obviously her art is a product of her past, and they're very sort of opposite styles, but in the end there's just this idea of kind of laying everything out and displaying yourself and all of your wounds in an effort to really show something and show people something. And I mean, you know, that was me as the kind of observer was continually fascinated by the experience of seeing that and continually inspired to continue making the film, because it felt like we were all in process on something together, and there was no contentment among any of us. We were all continually working on something, in whatever effort, was necessary.
You said the sort of Noriko in this transition in the way that she is what she's willing to take from her husband Ushio, and how she talks about her art compared to his. At the beginning of the film, Ushio says of his wife, he says, quote, "She's just an assistant. The average one has to support the genius. That's what I think." And the documentary captures Noriko sort of increasingly rebelling against that attitude of his. And I wonder, you followed them for so many years. Do you think that having an observer for her made her more strident with him?
You know, I think my presence was sort of, galvanizing a process that was already sort of well underway. I mean, you know, Noriko in a lot of ways commands power in the relationship from day one. I mean, and you can feel the tension and you can feel her sort of control in some ways over Ushio. And that was something that was sort of established from the day that I met them. I think with her artwork, she was definitely encouraged to not only continue the Cutie series, but to show it publicly, which is something she had, really only done a few times.
And the Cutie series is animations of her, of a woman character named Cutie standing up to a male character named Bully. So it's playing out the history of their relationship.
Cutie is the sort of alter ego she's created for herself in the form of comics. And the story is this sort of playful yet, ripe with tension display of the history of her marriage. But I think it's really, my presence really just sort of allowed or pushed forward, her own inclinations to show the work publicly and in a way that, where she didn't really care what Ushio would think. I mean, she's basically displaying in these comics a very ugly side of her husband, and a side that at some point in her life she probably would have been reticent to announce. And here she is sort of announcing to the world, and sometimes in the same setting as her husband's art, kind of what a terrible person he was when in the early years of their marriage. So I certainly think that, my interest in the film was really both artists, but the story and the complexity and the heart of the film is really in Noriko's character. So as I continued to film and Noriko continued to open up for me and continued to sort of push forward with not only, exposing the life of her and her husband, but talking about things that she hadn't really talked about, that became, my focus of the movie. And as a result, I think, the film ends with you sort of being in Noriko's corner, as I was in a way.
And also aware, though, of Ushio's vulnerabilities in a way that you aren't at the start of the film when he's, making these bold statements about his wife's lack of talent compared to his. You see him as an aging male who needs his wife desperately.
Absolutely. I mean, he's Ushio's character, he's sort of had the same spirit as when he was born in some ways. He's an eternal kind of child, and there's a lovability to that, and there's almost sometimes there's a disgust to that. You think, there's a purity to it, and there's something that I really find fascinating about the fact that he can sort of continue this life of a struggling artist. And the questions of does he really believe that success doesn't matter, and finding kind of where it becomes a display of pride and and, you know, or whether he can expose some sort of regret. And, I mean, the interesting thing about the footage that you mentioned earlier, you know, is that obviously I didn't shoot that footage. That was footage that we found. And even in the 5 years of me, you know, being in their house, living with them, I mean, there's a scene of me shooting Ushio when he goes and takes a shower, and that wasn't an abnormal scene. It was natural for me just to be there all of the time. But anyway, what's interesting is in those 5 years, I actually wasn't able to capture, you know, a moment that kind of exposed his vulnerability in that kind of way, because he is this constant performance. And in some ways, he is acting even when the camera, I mean, acting with or without the camera, because that's sort of who he is. And Noriko will comment that he's sort of always this facade. And so getting a moment of him really where he's in a less inhibited state and talking about how painful it is, but simultaneously how beautiful it is, you know, is incredibly important, obviously, to the film, and really, really changed, you know, the way that his character comes off. Because it's at times really hard to find any reason to kind of be sympathetic to his, you know, to sort of the sacrifices he's decided to make in the pursuit of being an artist.
So the Shinoharas left Soho for Dumbo, and that's where most of the film takes place, right there in their apartment and in their studio space. I have to ask, I mean, it's sort of a crass question, but their struggles with money and is such a kind of constant drama in the documentary. How have they been able to stay in Dumbo, the site of now multi-million dollar apartments?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, they're kind of the last of a dying breed. You know, I mean, they moved to Soho they moved to Dumbo in the 80s. You know, when it was pretty desolate, and they found this space, and they have an interesting relationship with their landlord. You know, if you see the film and the space is, you know, there's holes in the ceilings. It's sort of in a state of disarray. But I think that's a result of you know, the landlord really sort of allowing them to stay and also agreeing kind of not to basically demolish the building and put up a high rise is what they're doing in every building that surrounds them. So they've somehow gotten lucky, I think, that this building that they're in has sort of stayed in this state. There's still actually a sign that's fading away on the outside that says Artist's Loft, which is something it would be very hard to find in Dumbo today.
In Dumbo these days. One of the other main characters in the documentary is alcohol. I mean, you show Ushio's struggling with alcohol as a younger man, which you know lasted late into his life. He's not drinking when you start filming, as far as I can tell. But you also show their son Alex sneaking drinks from his parents' refrigerator. Tell me about alcohol in this family and how they talked about it.
It's interesting. I mean, it's very complicated, and I think the film really just scratches the surface. You know, I would say that Alex is, he's an incredibly brilliant artist. He's an incredibly complicated person, as everyone is. And I think in the film, I tried to limit his role to be sort of viewed in the context of his parents and almost as an unfortunate sacrifice that happens when, you know, when artists decide to really dedicate, you know, their lives to something. And, you know, there are people that are left. And I think with Alex, it was really hard to sort of make the decision that I was going to try to contextualize his alcoholism or contextualize who he was as an artist and sort of get inside of his art and you know, in the way that I was trying to do with Ushio and Noriko. So I sort of filmed a lot, developed a relationship with Alex, and then in the end decided really to just include a few select scenes. But, you know, the issue of alcohol, I think, is certainly different for Ushio than it was Alex. I mean, there's the obvious sort of nursing the kind of struggles that Ushio went through. But, you know, it was also, he was sort of known as this infamous partier. And he would invite, you know, all of these musicians and dancers and artists that were living in you know, bohemian Soho in the 70s and sleeping on the floors of lofts and paying little to no rent to his sort of grand palace and have these epic parties. And I think he became known for that. In a way, his identity was almost shaped by his ability to,
party
and, mm-hmm. and entertain. I mean, he's an entertainer. He's an entertainer in every aspect in his artwork, and if you just meet him, he will immediately start trying to entertain you. There's definitely a difference to that kind of alcoholism than, you know, to maybe others that are hinted at in the film, for sure.
Tell me about, you mentioned Ushio was an entertainer. I mean, now he's the star of an Oscar-nominated documentary. What has the family's reaction been as the film, for example, was first released and then its Oscar nomination? Tell me about what your conversations have been like of late.
It's been really, really amazing. I mean, certainly, you know, when you're making a film about what I would consider underappreciated artists, you know, we're really bringing their story, not only their artwork, but their story. And I think the story is something, you know, that inspires. And I think, you know, people are getting a chance to see their artwork. They're also getting a chance to learn about the unconventional lives of artists. And it's been really amazing to see that these sort of smaller, more personal film can really resonate with a wider audience. And people have been kind of, you know, discovering in their own way the Shinoharas in the way that the film kind of tries to discover them. I mean, it's really an underdog story. It's really a discovery, you know, of you know, that they're relatively unknown artists. I'm, you know, a first-time director. I think when people see the film, it's like, you know, they're uncovering some, you know, something, and part of that process is also included in sort of what I'm talking about. But I think it's been great, you know, for a number of reasons. I think for Noriko particularly, you know, she's really taken ownership over this film, and you know, every Q&A we have, she talks more and more and more, and Ushio talks less and less, and they have this kind of battle on stage, which is, you know, perfect and indicative of what you've seen in the film. But
yeah.
But she is really, you know, like I said, taking ownership of the film and is kind of utilizing it to really show her story and to kind of show her story to women all over. I mean, she's getting tons and tons and tons of love and support from lots of groups and from not only from artists but anyone that can kind of relate to her story. So it's been really great for Noriko.
And what are your plans for Oscar night?
Well, it's interesting. Ushio actually, in you know, he grew up relatively poor in Tokyo, and the first big work that he sold, I think, in maybe 1961, he went out and bought a tuxedo. he decided that he wanted to look good for his first show. So that tuxedo, which is over 50 years old, still fits him today, and he's going to be wearing that on the red carpet, which I'm excited by. And Noriko will be there as well. I'm excited by the idea of them sort of being out there among all of these stars. I mean, it's kind of a surreal image in my head and nothing that any of us would have expected, but...
Well, congratulations, Zachary Heinzerling, first-time filmmaker, director of Cutie and the Boxer, a documentary about Brooklynites Ushio and Noriko Shinohara. Congratulations on the nomination. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. And now our Oscar-nominated documentary series continues. We're talking with the filmmakers behind all the films nominated for Best Feature Documentary this year. Today, The Square, which tracks the Egyptian people's revolution over the course of 2 years. long after those images of the first protest in Tahrir Square that led to the resignation of Hosni Mubarak, the struggle continued and continues, and protesters returned to Tahrir Square over and over to make their voices heard and discuss the future of Egypt. Through heated arguments, police crackdowns, contested elections, and even attempts by the government to turn Tahrir itself into a public park, the square follows the protest long after the international media stopped paying as close attention. Jahon Najem is the director of The Square. Her previous films include The Control Room about Al Jazeera and Startup.com, which tracks the boom and bust of a tech company. This is her first Oscar nomination. Congratulations, Jahon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Jahon, I'm mispronouncing your first name.
We're absolutely thrilled to be among such incredible company.
Congratulations, and I'll get your name right since you're an Oscar-nominated director. Jahon Najem, welcome to WNYC. Let's start with just a little from the film right now. Almost all of it is in Arabic with English subtitles. But here's a little sound from inside Tahrir Square of protest in a song that protests the army takeover after Mubarak stepped down. You hear cheers of elation along with the words to that song. Translate that song for us. What's being sung there?
Rami is actually singing. Rami's an incredible character because he turns the chants of the revolution into songs of the revolution, and he's sort of like our musical narrator, has a song for every single phase of the revolution and the uprising to encourage the protesters. And in that song, he's talking about democracy. He's saying, you know, basically, it's sort of a sarcastic song where he's saying, you know, if you're ashamed, if your dignity's been taken away, put your head down low, but don't worry, because we're a democracy, because that was what the authorities were saying that they were moving towards.
So a satirical treatment of Egyptian democracy there. I mean, the images of those first protests in Tahrir Square with you know, people holding up a single finger for one Egypt. Describe those scenes and what it's like to watch now.
Well, the early days of the uprising were incredible. I make films because I see something beautiful. I meet characters I fall in love with, and I want to share these people with the world. And I grew up 10 minutes away from Tahrir. There was no place else I wanted to be. There were men, women in that square, all feeling like and fighting for the first time to have a hand in their future. I mean, remember, we come from a country which is the land of the pharaohs, and for 5,000 years we've looked to the strong man to lead us. And so to be in this atmosphere where people power were coming forward, where people were fighting for very basic human rights and social justice, was absolutely incredible. And so we began to capture that. Mubarak stepped down, and then we thought, how do we begin a film with a climax? And then we realized that we were the only cameras in the square, because after Mubarak stepped down, all of the international cameras left, all of the local cameras left, and you had your sort of dedicated few that decided to stay in the square, because what had happened was, even though Mubarak had left, the secret police were still in place, the rest of Mubarak's government was still in place, and they knew that they had to keep on going in order to fight for deep change in the country. And that's when our film really begins, because we saw quite quickly that in March, Rami Assam, the guy who was the singer, who was heralded as the hero of the revolution, was carted off, taken away from the square, cleared by the army, and brutally tortured in the Egyptian Museum. And nobody covered it, when weeks before he had been on every television show. And we thought, we have to cover this story, because this is the story that is not being told. And we've continued following those characters over the past 3 years in the square as they've gone through this roller coaster ride of change.
I want to talk about more of those characters. You mentioned Ramia, the singer. Let's talk about the main protagonist, Ahmed. Anyone who watches the documentary knows why he's such a compelling character. But for those who haven't seen it, tell us about him. How did you find him, and why were you drawn to following his experience?
Ahmed, I just, you meet him, everybody falls in love with him immediately. And he's a street poet. He's somebody who was... he grew up, his mother was a vegetable seller, illiterate. He's had every job you can think of. He went down to the square because he was frustrated with the fact that he felt he had no future. But he has this amazing ability to connect to people and has a really real understanding of what's happening on the streets. He predicts in the film, and a year before Morsi steps down and the Brotherhood is removed, that this is going to happen. So I fell in love with him and began following him. And you follow people who you know are going to take you to places that you would never otherwise get to see. And it's a real gift that these characters open their lives and trust you. And of course, the only reason they do is because you're sitting and sleeping in that square with them. You're in the tents. You're being tear gassed, potentially arrested, just like everybody else. But he really becomes the narrator of the film and really leads you through it.
One of the first shots of the movie shows him watching a video where a woman says, "I'm going to Tahrir Square to protest." Almost every other scene seems to have someone watching a YouTube video or uploading a video to the web. How important was YouTube to the revolution and to you as a filmmaker?
Well, YouTube and social media were a tool, just like any tool of the revolution. And what was incredible about watching people and their use of it was that you could see one story was, for example, Cressida True, one of our filmmakers. I mean, the entire group of filmmakers met in the square. It was a very organic process. So this film really grew out of the square. She was Khaled, one of the other main characters, wife. And one day when the army is clearing the square, she and the police are in the square, she films from above, and she films a body being dragged across the square and being dumped in the garbage. And she uploaded that to YouTube. That was then picked up by international news stations. The local news could then not avoid playing it. And within hours, you had thousands of people coming down to the square in solidarity saying, "Not in my name." And it was an incredible example of how one image could actually affect things on the ground. Now as we're releasing the film, it's amazing what's happening online because we've released on Netflix, because also the film has now been taken on to BitTorrents because Egyptians were not waiting for it to come to Egypt, and we've had some issues getting through censorship there. About 1.5 million people have watched it in Egypt now and shared and discussed online. And so we're in this changing world where people are having these online discussions, posting things on YouTube, posting things on social media, translating what Ahmed's lines are and Khalid's lines are into over 10 languages. I've seen one of the lines in the film is Ahmed says, "We're looking for a conscience." And that's been translated into Chinese, Spanish, Portuguese. People are having conversations online about this desire for young people to change their relationship with their government. And it's a very exciting time because people are interconnected in a way that they never have been before.
And you're making this film as those relationships are being forged, as history is unfolding. So I'm so interested in how the selection of the characters in that moment of solidarity in Tahrir Square when Mubarak left office and how it's continued since. That solidarity has, of course, broken down. I want to talk to you about a man named Magdi. He's a character in the documentary. He's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. At first in the square, he's part of the United crowd. But, of course, after Mubarak steps down and the army fills the vacuum, there are elections. Mohamed Morsi is elected on the Muslim Brotherhood slate. This leads to tensions and crackdowns and strained relations between Magdi and the original protesters and revolutionaries. Did you know, as a filmmaker, when you were putting together the people you were going to follow, how did you think about Muslim Brotherhood as a character and Magdi in particular?
Well, we met Magdi and we found him to be a fascinating character because he was with the Muslim Brotherhood for 25 years. Yet he had an openness to talk with very different people with very different backgrounds and very different beliefs than he did. And he became an interesting character because he changed over the course of the film. He questioned his relationship with the Brotherhood. He questioned what they were doing. And over the course of the film, you see the relationship between Ahmed and Magdi. As politics drives them apart, they continue to have this deep friendship and this deep caring for one another. Obviously, it's a very difficult time for all of them. Magdi's house was raided 3 days ago by the police. His computer was taken. He's currently in hiding, which is a very, very difficult time for them. And they have given such so much to the world by being in this film because they've put themselves out there in a way that puts them at risk. But they are continuing. If you talk to each one of them, they each say this is a dark time that we're going through in Egypt, but we still believe in those initial, in the initial fight, this fight for very basic human rights, for social justice for everybody, for the respect of every citizen, no matter what their background is. And they all say that this is a long fight, and they're not going back. So they're not going back to a time pre-Mubarak. So they're optimism, their deep optimism, even through these very dark times as people are being arrested, is absolutely inspiring. And we feel like by releasing a film like this at this time, it's giving hope to people who did believe in that this struggle would continue. And it's a very difficult time to release a film like this because the country is very divided. But it's actually the most crucial time to be releasing this film as well. If you think about post-September 11th in the United States, we went through this process of dehumanizing the other because we were afraid and the government was putting fear into all of our minds. And that's what made us it so easy to go into Afghanistan, to go into Iraq. And the same kind of thing is happening in Egypt right now, where it's such a simple concept, but the idea that we must respect each other as human beings and respect each other's humanity, if the film shows anything, it shows that no matter what background we come from, we're all human beings, and that we deserve to live in a country that respects each other's rights no matter who we are.
I'm speaking with Jahan Nujaim, the director of The Square, an Oscar-nominated documentary this year. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. This is WNYC FM, HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. Jahan, you mentioned that this is unfolding. This is a time of great divisiveness in Egypt. And so I want to ask you about some of the criticism of the film. And a lot of it seems to me to come down to the question of who is a reliable narrator of the situation on the ground in Egypt right now. The film's been criticized for its depiction of post-Morsi or Egypt. It's seen as been criticized as overly sympathetic to secular elites and perhaps sympathetic to the army post-Morsi. How do you respond to that?
We've been criticized. The majority, if you look online and the 1.5 million views, the majority of those views, I'd say 85-90%, and it's young people online, are giving likes to the film, and the emotion that we've gotten from people, the emotional tweets and responses of people saying that they've given hope again, and that they've been given hope again in something that they thought was lost, has been absolutely incredible. Of course, you have the establishment of different sides, of the Brotherhood on one side, of the army on the other side, of leaders of the establishment that say that this is politically leaning to this side or the other. But in fact, these people have missed the point. This is a very human story that does not pretend to be a pro-Brotherhood, pro-army, pro-this or pro-that. This is pro-human. And we focused on three people mainly in this square who were from very different backgrounds. Magdi from the Muslim Brotherhood, Khaled, who's an actor who could have been anywhere in the world but chose to be in that square, Ahmed, who grew up in a very poor section of Egypt. And the film shows their deep humanity. It puts people in their shoes. I think the incredible thing about film and about art is that you're able to transport people in. It's kind of like time travel. I made my first film with Penny Baker, who made films in the 60s, Penny Baker and Chris Hegedus. And you watch their films and you feel like you're sitting in the back of the car with Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. And what we hope to do in this film is to really allow people 50 years, 100 years from now to transport them into the shoes of what it felt to actually be one of these characters in the square.
You started screening the film when it had a different ending. How did you choose the ending when history is unfolding in Egypt?
Oh, we the first time we screened the film was when we took it to Sundance, and it was the first sort of ending that we could find was with the election of Morsi. And at that time, we thought, okay, here is a logical storyline. It follows a political storyline, which is the bringing down of a dictator in, to the election of a president. But as we were on our way to Sundance, a couple of weeks before we actually showed at Sundance, all of our characters were back in the streets. All of them were saying, this is this first freely elected president, and he's using the tools of democracy to create another dictatorship. And so we knew we had to keep filming. And so we went back, we kept filming, and we finally ended in a place where, because this is a character-driven story, we ended in a place where our characters had gone through a conclusion for themselves. They got to the conclusion that no matter who is in power, they have to keep struggling to hold government accountable. And that's a universal topic that we have to deal with here in the States as well. Now, since the film has ended, there's been very important political events that happened, but we're not a news organization. So much as we would like to continue documenting everything that happens, that's for journalists to do. And we have incredible people on the ground. There's Musrin, the social citizen journalist network that Khalid has created that we always point people to that are on the ground filming. But we got to a place where our characters had said, what we're looking for is we're looking for a consciousness. We're looking for, and what that tangibly means is a constitution that respects the rights of every Egyptian citizen. And they also got to the point where they said, this is going to be a very long struggle, and we're at the very beginning of it. And if you look at the civil rights movement, if you look at the fight against apartheid, if you look at any great struggle across the world, these struggles take time. And there's nothing that makes me crazier than when I read things in the papers here that it's over in Egypt, that the door has been closed, that it's a complete failure. Because what does it do to these people, these beacons of light that are still struggling every day as we speak here on the phone, on this radio show? We have, you know, Raji Omran, who is fighting every day to get thousands out of prison. There are people that are still struggling today, and we need to remember that they have a long fight ahead of them, and we need to have their backs.
Let's listen to one more clip from the film. This is Khalid, the Egyptian-born actor you mentioned who became one of the leaders of the movement. Let's listen to how he defines success.
We won't know if this revolution has succeeded for decades. There is no way in which the goals of this revolution, bread, freedom, social justice, dignity, there is no way in which those things can be achieved in 2 years. What you can do is lay the ground for them to actually happen.
Is that your perspective at this point?
I do believe that it is a long struggle, yes.
Do you feel, you said you feel like the film is a call to recall the hopefulness. Do you feel hopeful about Egypt today in the midst of this divisiveness?
I would be, to ignore that it's a very dark time, to ignore that I currently have dear friends in prison. I have a friend of mine who I went to high school with who's in prison right now. To ignore that this is happening, I'm not going to say that it's not happening, but we can't continue looking at the success or failure of a struggle like this, that based on the political outcomes. There are many other outcomes besides political outcomes, and the struggle is long. The thing that keeps me optimistic are the people that I know are on the ground fighting on very different levels. And that's what keeps me hopeful. Those are the people that I'm talking to, that even though they get depressed, of course, it's a long struggle, they are continuing to move forward, and they're not going to give up. And I can't, Egypt's my country. I am a very proud Egyptian. My family lives there. And so, no, I don't look at the situation and throw up my hands and give up on it. I am deeply optimistic that ultimately our country is going to change. We also have to think about it as not necessarily revolution, but evolution. And sometimes that happens at a very slow snail's pace.
And you say political outcomes are not a fair way to only judge what happened in Tahrir Square. But watching the film, there are moments of strategic transitions that I imagine for some protesters, there's moments of frustration. At one point, Ahmed says, the biggest mistake we made was to leave the square before the power was in our hands. Is it difficult to watch back some of those transitions and those moments that you know went in a way where the solidarity in the square when Mubarak left ultimately broke down?
Oh, of course. It's sometimes like watching a home movie, you know, when you watch difficult times where you make mistakes. But this was the point of making a film like this. We often see the greatest hits of change. We see Martin Luther King as he's on his Million Man March. We see the bloodiest battle, or we see the election or the victory. We don't see Martin Luther King or Gandhi or people fighting for change when they are in their deepest, most depressed moments. We don't see them when they've been made the biggest mistake or when they feel alone and unsupported by anybody. But that's what was crucial to show in a film like this, because people need to understand that change takes a long time and that there are very lonely moments in this process and many mistakes that are made.
The movie ends with Ahmed saying, we are not looking for a leader to rule us because everyone who went to Tahrir is a leader. He asks, what was the revolution's biggest accomplishment? Is it that the kids today play a game called protest? Do you see this as the biggest legacy as well, this sense that protest can be successful in some ways?
Well, I think what he's saying, I think he's using that as an example to signify that there is a culture that has changed in Egypt. And if you think about something like the civil rights movement in the U.S., even though not all of the laws were put in place when we struggled, which were struggled for during the civil rights movement, there was a consciousness change and a consciousness shift. People would not put up in the United States with the same things that they did before the civil rights movement. They would not put up with the same things that they put up with before the civil rights movement, after the civil rights movement. And I think that's what's happening here as well. And the fact is we are 70% of the population is under 40 in Egypt and in many countries that are fighting for change in the Middle East. And so it is important to look at that and to look at how kids are watching and young people are watching what's happening and the cultural change that's happened and the art that's exploded, the kind of singing and music and poetry and expression that's happened in these last years has been absolutely unbelievable. And that affects people.
I do want to ask, though, I mean, the sense of hopefulness and optimism about profound change in Egypt, about economic opportunities and democracy. You get that sense so acutely watching the first minutes of Tahrir Square with the first protest prior to Mubarak stepping down. Why no concrete political platform or outcomes out of the characters that you were following?
Well, our characters decided there's many films to be made about this issue. There's films to be made about the election process. There's films to be made about the judiciary. There's films to be made about creating a political platform. There's, you know, calling this film a film about, you know, the revolution would be wrong. It's not a film that gives an overview of the revolution and all of the pieces in it. That would be a little bit like making a film about World War II. I don't know how I would even begin to do that. But what this film is about three characters who decide that they are going to use this square, this public piece of land, as a political tool for change. And we concentrated on that because we thought this is the zeitgeist of the time. There are squares that are erupting in Turkey, in Greece, in Kiev. Our film just showed in the square in Kiev the other day, translated and has been watched by thousands of people. We showed it in a public square in Mexico. So it was really about the use of this public space for change. And so that's what we concentrated on, because they felt like these are activists that wanted to use the street. And they felt this was important because when you have issues with freedom of press, when you don't have a fair judiciary, this is a moment in time that we were going through that Khaled and Ahmed and Megdi felt like this was their way of expressing themselves. And so that's what you see in the film.
Jahan, we're getting a few questions from callers about how they can see the film. Michael in Queens, you have a question about the distribution of the square?
Yes, good morning. And first of all, I want to say congratulations to you, Director Jahan, on your nomination. Well deserved. I wanted to ask, what actually influenced you to release your documentary, The Square, via Netflix online as opposed to the traditional medium of in theaters? And secondly, how do you actually keep also attention on Egypt's changing political landscape with the international media when the attention doesn't always seem to be there?
Thanks for your question, Michael. Jahan, why Netflix?
So we made this film, the last shoot happened in July, and there were a few reasons. First of all, we had a number of offers come in, but Netflix wanted to release it quite quickly, and we felt like if we went the theater route, it wouldn't be available widely to a public for probably another 6 months from now. And we felt this is something that is happening on the ground right now in Egypt. By releasing this film widely, we have the ability to affect the conversation on the ground. I don't think that film necessarily has the ability to change the world, but it can change conversation, and we've already had people coming up to us, Egyptians that have come up to us. I think the most memorable is a number of women that came up to me and brought all of their families after a public screening, and they said, you know, our families are divided, half pro-brotherhood, half pro-army, and they haven't been speaking with each other because of these deep political divides. And seeing this film has allowed us to actually have a conversation. And that's what's so crucial in the country right now. So the first reason was that it allowed us to release it quickly, and that was crucial given that what's happening right now in Egypt needs to be talked about and discussed. The second issue was that it really gave us the ability to reach the most wide and diverse audience possible. And because of the low cost of Netflix, we felt like our audience is a lot. We wanted young people to see it. We wanted young people to have access to it. The third part, which has happened, which is wonderful, is that because people see it on Netflix, it's online, they then go to hashtag The Square on Twitter, or they go to our Facebook page, The Square on our Facebook page, and continue the conversation. And so that's really exciting because this is supposed to be a conversation starter. And so watching people coming by the thousands to have that conversation afterwards has been really exciting for us as filmmakers.
Finally, for non-Netflix users and Egyptians in Egypt, you mentioned it's on BitTorrent, but any other ways for people to get access to The Square to see it?
We're figuring out internationally. We are, Netflix has its territories, which is North America, South America, Netherlands. And so in other places, we will be working with television stations and online as well. In Egypt, we are currently going through the difficult process of censorship. However, what's been quite incredible is that Egyptians have, now that it's the first Egyptian Oscar-nominated film, it's a female director. And over 40 Egyptians made it and put it together, and it was really birthed out of the square. There's been a lot of talk about it in Egypt. It's been shared, it's been downloaded, it's been taken to coffee shops. It's like a football game. People have sold tickets at coffee shops to see the film. So it's provoked a great deal of discussion, and a lot of people have wanted to see it. So we are trying to go through the process of censorship, which would allow the film to open in theaters in Egypt, and we're still hoping for that. But meanwhile, there's been a lot of sharing of it online, and we will be releasing a full-quality version online that people can download for Egypt, in Egypt.
Jahan Nujaim is the director of The Square, an Oscar-nominated documentary this year. Again, congratulations, Jahan, and thank you for joining us on WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up after the break, we'll look at the second machine age and what business models will position us for progress and prosperity in the digital age. And that is The Talking Heads. Of course you knew that, Slippery People. And David Byrne, everybody knows David Byrne, but do you know who all the other voices were? Well, you're about to find out a whole lot about the other voices in that piece of music and more. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer, and it's time now for our annual series on Oscar-nominated documentaries. Today, we are going to continue with the wonderful film 20 Feet from Stardom, from which that piece of sound emerged, the untold true story of the backup singers behind that piece of music and some of the other greatest musical legends of the 21st century. Morgan Neville is the director of the film 20 Feet from Stardom. His other credits include Troubadours, Carole King, James Taylor, and The Rise of the Singer-Songwriter, The Night James Brown Saved Boston, and Johnny Cash's America. He joins us now, despite all the snowy weather that almost kept him from joining us today. Morgan, I can't thank you enough for the effort you've made to be here. I really appreciate it. Congratulations to you on the nomination.
Thank you so much. I'd hope to be there in person, but at least I can make it on the phone.
Oh, we're so pleased that you're here in any form. And we want to talk a little bit about the clip we just heard. And also, we could listen to clips from this film all day, right? This is an incredible soundtrack. How did you, we just heard Talking Heads, how did you decide which of the very many incredible acts you could feature, the singers, you know, you're talking about 20 Feet from Stardom, the people behind the scenes, the voices behind the scenes, which acts to focus on, who to select to be essentially the stars of the untold story of these background singers. Who did you single out and why?
Well, when I first started the project, when I first started to put together a list of songs with great backup vocals, I couldn't really come up with more than half a dozen. And even though I know music very well and am a real music geek, you know, I had never thought about it that way. And the more I looked, the more I realized nobody had ever really thought about backing vocals that way. And so what I had to do was retrain my ear to go back and listen to thousands and thousands of songs and discover for the first time backup vocals in songs I knew very, very well. And in the process of making the film, we collected hundreds and hundreds of songs with great backing vocals. That was one part of the journey. And the other part was just meeting as many singers as I could. I think ultimately we interviewed probably 80. And once I figured out who the characters were and the singers were who most captured my imagination and excited me and had incredible stories and voices and personas, the songs and the artists all kind of came out of that. So really it started with the characters and then the songs and then trying to match it all up. And it was tough because nobody, you know, sometimes I'd look for footage of a great backup singing song and the camera would never show the backup singers.
Right.
So it became a very, very difficult thing because by their very definition, they're invisible. They're in the background.
And you're not shooting it yourself. You have to work with what you've got to work with.
Exactly. I mean, that clip you just played is from Stop Making Sense. And that was, you know, one of those rare examples where David Byrne and the Talking Heads really took the backup singers and put them way up front. And, you know, it's one of the most infectious pieces of backup singing performance footage I found, and I just had to include it. But that's the exception. Usually, you know, the backup singers are wearing the little black dresses, and they're standing in the back, and maybe the camera shows them once, you know.
Right.
And that was tough.
And let's talk about some of the characters specifically in the film, because you interview an incredible number of superstars for the film, Bruce Springsteen, Mick Jagger, Stevie Wonder, Sting. I know I'm leaving people out. I think Bette Midler.
Sure. But these people really are not the stars of this film. It's amazing the way they just sort of fall behind the curtain, and the stars of the film are the backup singers who for so long, really we've never thought about them, and they become the stars of your film. One of the better known of these is Darlene Love, and her story is quite amazing. Tell us a little bit about her and how you came to focus on her.
Sure. Well, I mean, Darlene is, in a way, the world's most famous backup singer, which is kind of an oxymoron, if you think about it. You know, but Darlene started out with a group called the Blossoms, who were kind of the top L.A. session singers in the early 60s. They eventually signed to Phil Spector's label. He flirted with making Darlene a star in her own right and basically had her put vocals on all kinds of records he was putting out, whether or not they came out under her name. Sometimes they were her name. Sometimes it was Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans. Sometimes it was the Crystals. And, you know, Darlene was somebody who people knew. She was on the house band on Shindig, which was a big 60s rock and roll shown nationally. And her story is amazing because she's somebody who by all rights should have been a star. You know, she had the voice, she had the look, she had everything going for her, except for the fact that she was signed to Phil Spector. And Phil Spector wasn't interested in making stars per se because he was the star in the situation.
Hmm.
And it was just one of those crazy music industry stories that is as dysfunctional as it can be.
Yes. I mean,
she was basically kind of kept from recording under her own name for years and years.
And people would lip sync to her music, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. You know, people talk about Milli Vanilli, who was the disgraced band that won the Grammy in the early 90s. And when I would mention this to the old session singers from the 60s and 70s, they laughed and said, oh, we were Milli Vanilli before Milli Vanilli was Milli
right.
Vanilli. You know, we were doing that all the time. The idea of what they call ghost vocals,
mm-hmm.
where basically the session singers would sing the leads for, you know, weaker but perhaps, you know, more famous or better looking singers. And, you know, that practice still goes on.
Yeah, and she talks about losing her musical identity, which seems to me, Morgan, to be a thread that runs throughout the film.
Well, it's
one
of the threads.
Do you agree?
It's certainly one of the threads. I mean, the thing is that backup singers are incredibly talented. I mean, that's one thing that just struck me instantly, is that they're not backup singers because they're not as good. They're backup singers because they can do anything, and they have to be perfect on the first take and the 50th take. Lead singers don't have to do that.
Mm.
So you keep asking yourself, well, why aren't they the lead singer then? And
so why aren't they?
Well, that's what the film, you know, talks about it and approaches it from many different angles. And there's so many reasons. I mean, one big takeaway, I think, from the film is that, you know, being a recording artist is about so much more than just talent. It's about ambition and luck and timing and, you know, all those kinds of things. And, you know, really, I think a lot of backup singers are so naturally talented that they've never had to be ambitious about their talent. You know, it was something that they just took for granted. And when it came time for them to be their own recording artists and they had to shake the hands and do the photo sessions and deal with managers and publicists, you know, they just weren't equipped for it. And I think another problem is that they're professional chameleons. I mean, they can do anything.
Yeah.
And so the recording industry says you have to be one thing, and that's what we're going to sell. And I think a lot of them have a hard time figuring out what that one thing is because they can do everything.
And that is also what makes the film so interesting, because you are following a number of different personalities who then go off in many different directions to do all sorts of things. One becomes a very religious person. One woman poses for Playboy. Just incredibly diverse areas of talent across a range of styles also, and starting in the 1960s, pretty much the present. So it's really an incredible journey. Let's talk about one of the best examples from your film. First, let's listen to Gimme Shelter, one of the best known songs by the Rolling Stones. And then we're going to focus on the backup singer, Mary Clayton. Here's the full version.
Yeah, I'm gonna burn you, burn.
All right. And everyone, I think, is pretty familiar with that. And here is Mary Clayton from a little later in the song, Isolated. Morgan Neville, that is one of the most powerful moments, I think, in the movie. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I still get goosebumps just listening
to
that.
Yeah, yeah. It makes, I think, the point.
It does, and it's one of those things that, you know, Give Me Shelter is one of the most famous rock songs of all time, but how many of us have stopped and thought about how that song was really made by that vocal? I mean, it's more than a backup vocal in a way. You know, the whole third verse is her singing, and it's just so powerful. And when you strip it away like that, it just reveals in all of its, you know, glorious nakedness how incredible these singers are.
Yeah. And so what happens to Mary?
So Mary, I mean, the story about the recording of that actual song is that, you know, she got a call in the middle of the night, and she was pregnant at the time, and her friend, the producer Jack Nietzsche, said, "You've got to get down here. There's a band called the Rolling Stones," and she'd never heard of them. And he said, "Well, they'll send a car for you." So they did, and she showed up with curlers in her hair and a morning coat on and sang that at 2 in the morning. It's a little different than the mental image you might have of that song. But she killed it. And she said she did it, you know, 3 times and said, "Okay, I'm going to bed." Got back in the car and went home.
Amazing. Truly amazing. And the image that you describe of a smoky jazz club and a jam session of some sort is the one we have when we hear the track. But, of course, now you lay bare the real story. And I think the larger film lays bare the real story of the lives of so many of these people who are 20 feet from stardom. But it's not all bitter. Much of it is sweet. Right, Neville?
No, not at all. And Morgan, the thing is, if all you care about is actually being a singer, then in a way the backup world might be the perfect place for you.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the singers told me, you know, they see people come along and have a hit song and disappear in a few years. And they get paid to do this decade in, decade out.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what you love, it's a great career to have.
They're working
and getting paid to do it. You know, you just have to be really, really good to survive, though.
And one of your featured artists, in fact, wins a Grammy.
Yeah, and that's Lisa Fisher, you know, who it was really important for me to have her in there. I mean, not only is she an amazing, amazing singer, but she was a backup singer with Luther Vandross and kind of a protege of his. And she got a record deal and she put out a record. It was a number one hit. It won a Grammy. And she had everything going for her. She was beautiful. She was on a major label. And she looked around and said, "You know what? This isn't for me. I just want to sing. I don't want to deal with all this other stuff that being a recording artist is about." And she went back to the backup world and never put out a second record, which is amazing. And she's been the main backup singer for the Rolling Stones for 25 years now. She's on the road with them right now.
Wow. Happier 20 feet from stardom.
Yeah, it was the right decision for her. That's the thing is, you know, everybody has to make their own decision of what's right for them. And in a way, that's what the film gets to be about, which is it's about finding your own happiness in the life you lead rather than, you know, what people tell you success is or what the record industry says success is. It's about finding what your own personal success is.
And speaking of success, you've had great success with this film, obviously. Congratulations again on the nomination and with your previous films. What inspired you to tell this story? What gave you the idea for this film?
I mean, it was my producer, Gil Friesen, who was a veteran record industry man. He used to run A&M Records. And he had the hunch that something was interesting about backup singers. I mean, it was as simple as that. It was kind of half of an idea. And he said to me, you know, I think something's interesting. If you can show me that there's a movie there, then we'll make it.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a few months interviewing backup singers, 50 of them, right up front, and very quickly realized that we had stumbled upon this world that was at once incredibly present in our lives, and we knew their mm-hmm. voices, but at the same time completely invisible, and nobody had ever done anything about them. And, you know, we just realized it was this incredible opportunity to not only tell a different version of pop music history, but to really explore this whole community of incredible artists that people didn't know about.
How much of it, and in just a minute, if you can, it's a hard question to tackle quickly, how much of it is about race?
I think a portion of it is, certainly. I mean, the story I focused on was really the revolution in backup singing, which was the influx of these African-American voices from the church and into the studios. And that happened at the same time that the way music was being recorded changed, and the rock producers coming in and wanting things that were looser and more soulful. And that was a great boon to these singers. But at the same time, when they tried to go solo, I think it became a liability because there were only so many slots, as many of them told me, to have, you know, an Aretha Franklin or a Diana Ross at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there just wasn't a lot of room for a lot of gospel-based black singers, no matter how great they were. And that was a real frustration to them.
Mm. Well, it is such a worthwhile film. It has so much fabric about the music business, but also about the American dream. And I commend everyone to see it, and I wish you the best of luck, Morgan Neville. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you for having me.
And that is our show for today. I am Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. More tomorrow.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer today, and it's time for the last installment in our series on Oscar-nominated feature documentaries. Our next guests take us down the rabbit hole of national security intelligence and shed light on controversial methods used in 21st century American warfare. Their film, Dirty Wars, looks at counterterrorism strategies employed by the United States. With us today are investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill and filmmaker Rick Rowley. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
So listeners, if you've seen Dirty Wars, call in with your questions. Here's your chance to ask the filmmakers anything you've wondered about how the film was made or the arguments presented. Call us with your questions, 212-433-WNYC. We're here with Jeremy Scahill and Rick Rowley, but the makers of the documentary Dirty Wars, call us at 212-433-9692. So, Jeremy, I want to start with the night raid at Gardez, Afghanistan. That's where you present that you're first tipped off about the existence and capabilities of JSOC, that is the Joint Special Operations Command. Tell us about that visit to Gardez and what it made you discover about what had shifted in terms of American strategy in Afghanistan.
Right. This incident happened very early on in the Obama administration, and Rick and I had gone to Afghanistan not with the intent to make a film about sort of the state of global covert warfare, but we wanted to look at the impact of President Obama pledging to escalate the war in Afghanistan on the campaign trail. And we noticed very early on that he had selected General Stanley McChrystal, who had spent his entire life in covert operations, to run the conventional war there. So we knew that there was going to be sort of an increase of unconventional tactics. And what we went to Afghanistan to do was to look at a series of night raids that were being conducted where journalists weren't allowed to embed with the soldiers, and there would be these conflicting reports. NATO would say that no civilians were killed. Local people were saying that there were 5-6 civilians killed in some of these episodes. So we investigated somewhere 10 or 12 night raids, And one in particular was extremely gruesome, and we learned about it through our colleague Jerome Starkey at the Times of London. And we traveled to Gardez, into this small village outside of Gardez, and met with this family. And what we discovered when we went there is that there was a raid that happened on the night when this family was celebrating the birth of a child in their house, and they were going through a ritual to name the child, when U.S. forces raided the house, believing that the people inside were Taliban. Well, they weren't Taliban, and what it turned out, the victims turned out to be a senior police commander who was working with the United States, another man and three women, two of whom were pregnant. Now, these kinds of raids happen all the time, where the U.S. goes in based on bad intelligence, and then it goes up the chain of command, and you know, no one is ever court-martialed for it, but then they pay compensation to the families and say, well, that's just war. What happened in this case was that the soldiers actively covered up the fact that they had killed these people, and they dug the bullets out of the bodies to try to remove evidence that they were American munitions, and then they blamed it on the Taliban and on a sort of honor killing that was done by the family, which was a sort of twisted thing. And so when, as we investigated it, we learned that the force that had done this raid was this elite unit called the Joint Special Operations Command. And we knew that because the commander of that unit, who at that time was a classified individual, his identity was classified, shows up in the village with a couple of sheep and offers to sacrifice them. And so a colleague of ours had taken a picture of him that day, and it said McRaven on his chest. We started to investigate who he was, and from there we entered this whole world of covert operations with these special ops forces.
So in that particular case, you have this image of McRaven there offering the sheep, which is basically, you argue in the film, demonstrating that the United States realized it made a mistake in killing these men and their family members, pregnant family members. Talk to me about the reporting on figuring out when the United States made a mistake and when they didn't make a mistake.
Right. You mean in this incident or in general?
Just in general, when you're looking at these counterterrorism operations.
Right. You know, it can be difficult to confirm details because it becomes a sort of he said, she said episode where you have U.S. forces or other NATO forces saying, oh, we went in, we killed five militants, we took three suspected militants prisoner, and no civilians were injured. And then you hear, you know, locals saying everyone that was killed or captured had nothing to do with the Taliban. And you know, there were cases where we investigated raids and it seemed like what NATO said happened. There were other cases, though, where we were able to put together actual hard evidence that what NATO was saying was not, in fact, true. I wrote a book as we were making this film. Mm-hmm. The film isn't based on the book. The book isn't based on the film. We were doing both at the same time. It's like 700 pages long and gets into, you know, very fine detail on this raid and a number of other raids. But it can be very difficult, especially when you're dealing with a location where there's no local reporters, there's no local human rights groups, and you're dealing with a population that's largely illiterate or not very well educated, describing in some cases, complicated weaponry that was used and personnel, and you know, it's unclear if they know what language people are speaking. I mean, one thing that was shocking to Rick and I when we were traveling in Afghanistan for this film, we would meet people who were not even aware that the United States was a country, had never heard of 9/11, and thought that the Russians were still occupying Afghanistan. And you know, that's actually fairly common in rural parts of Afghanistan. They just view it as foreigners are here. And so when that's the case, it becomes harder to sift through the details. But we, you know, we only put stories in the film where we had volumes of documentation to back up the stories that we were telling.
So, Rick, talk to me about the storytelling techniques in this film, because, Jeremy, you mentioned you have a 700-page book where you're able to get into all the intricacies of this. You frame the documentary basically about a reporter's journey. Jeremy Scahill is the main character, and we're following him as he discovers what JSOC is up to. Tell me about how you figured out to tell, how you thought about telling the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, and Jeremy was very resistant to that, actually. He had to sort of be dragged into it. But, you know, I mean, I've been a war reporter for since the beginning of the Iraq War is when I started to cover the war. And I made like a dozen sort of half-hour docs from Iraq, Afghanistan, and other wars in the region. And a continual frustration that you have working like that is that it's hard to pitch your voice, to hit the hearing of the audience that matters the most, an American audience. I mean, we make films like this because we want to show the human face of the war, show how the war is lived by the people who really experience it on the ground, whether that's, you know, villagers in rural Afghanistan or Bedouins living under the sound of the drones in Yemen or whatever. And so the way to do that, and the thing that film does, I think, better than any other medium, is create the possibility for these, you know, a feeling of vicarious identification by the audience with human beings who are they're separated from by this massive geographic or political distance. And so Jeremy needed to be a vehicle through which, a surrogate for the audience, so that they could feel and experience those relationships through him. So that is on just the first level why it's necessary to use Jeremy as sort of a point of entry through it. Also, you know, we go to three continents. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we're filming in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia, and you need a character and a thread to kind of weave through that and hold together this what could become or spiral into this kind of senseless orgy of violence in this this archipelago of wars. But thirdly, and I think actually in the end most importantly, this film is not just about there are two halves to the film. Part of it is this blistering exposé about a war that's gone off the tracks and that's spiraling out of control and producing more enemies than it's killing outside in the around the world. The other part is about what this war has done to us as a country, how it's transformed our not just the nature of our republic, you know, by this rapid expansion of executive powers and all the other things that that entails, but also how it. That I think the poison from these wars, it leaches into the ground, and the weight of these wars, you know, even if we aren't conscious of it, we carry it as a culture. And so, you know, the audience gets to see Jeremy having to bear the weight after witnessing it directly. And that was important to us.
And the audience also gets a sense of the difficulty of reporting on this when the official sources don't want to tell you what they're up to in terms of counterterrorism. At one point, Jeremy, you speak with someone from JSOC who agrees to speak with you if his face is blackened and his voice is disguised. Let's listen to a clip first of what he had to say about JSOC.
We're now seeing the effects of covert intervention in countries on multiple continents. Without any thought of future repercussions.
But in theory, Congress is supposed to have oversight of these operations.
They don't want to step into the dark and see what goes on behind the curtain. Joint Special Operations Command became a paramilitary arm of the administration, and billions upon billions of dollars was poured into JSOC. What we have essentially done is created one hell of a hammer. And for the rest of our generation, for the rest of my lifetime, this force will be continually searching for a nail.
So we see him speaking with you. We know he's somehow associated with JSOC, but that's all the audience gets to know. What can you tell us more about this particular source?
Well, very little because of the promises that I made as a journalist. In the book, this there is more detail about this character because you get a sense of some of the places that he's been and the operations that he's been a part of. But you know, getting anyone to agree in any form to go on camera is very difficult. This is a very small community of people, and they know each other. And so, you know, while in my print reporting, it's much easier to cultivate numerous sources, to get anyone to actually say yes, I'll sit down and allow you to film me, was a big leap of faith. And you know, you don't just meet a confidential source and say, hey, we're going to shoot a documentary. Can we film you next week? I mean, it was over a year and a half of negotiating how this would happen. But this is an individual who has been a part of very sensitive operations in the Horn of Africa, on the Arabian Peninsula, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and has worked alongside some of the most significant figures in the covert U.S. military apparatus. You know, and has a tremendous amount of insight into how these operations work. No one, the White House, the Pentagon, State Department, none of those entities would provide us with anyone to go on camera for this film at all. In fact, the White House, Pentagon, and State Department were asked the other day by CNN when they did a feature about our film, you know, about the reporting in the film, and they all said that they wouldn't be having any comment on Dirty Wars. So
whatsoever. I'm speaking with investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill and filmmaker Rick Rowley about Dirty Wars, an Oscar-nominated feature documentary this year. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Tom's River. So, Jeremy, I want to ask you, the very end of the film makes the argument that there's been a fundamental shift in the last decade in an expansion of counterterrorism operations and how the U.S. does it. Dirty Wars, the name, comes from U.S. involvement in Latin America. So how is what's happening now in terms of U.S. raids in places where war hasn't been declared, how is it different now than those examples?
Right. I mean, we didn't choose the name Dirty Wars for this project to be masters of the obvious. You know, there is no such thing as a clean war. But as you say, part of it was a kind of tip of the hat in a macabre way to this really dirty era where the U.S. was supporting right-wing military dictatorships, paramilitary forces that were effectively death squads, and you had the kind of hidden hand of the CIA or the U.S. military involved widely in Central and Latin America. And the other side of it, though, was that President Obama, because of who he is, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, a constitutional lawyer by training, has sort of sold this idea, particularly to liberals, and in a pretty effective way, that he's waging a smarter, cleaner war than his predecessor because he's relying on drones to hunt down individuals and to take them out before they can kill us. There's very little, to directly answer your question, there's very little new in war except technology. And, you know, the state of things with the National Security Agency, its ability to track metadata, to build profiles of people by monitoring their electronic communications, the use of drones that can be piloted by individuals who are sitting in trailers half a world away, has made it easier for presidents to engage in covert operations without having to risk the lives of their own soldiers. What I would say is most significant is that coming out of the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, where there was this incredible executive power grab, President Obama, who I think a lot of liberals thought was going to roll that back, has actually solidified assassination, they call it targeted killing, but assassination as a central component of U.S. National security policy. So what I think is different here is that we're entering an era that could be sort of described as a Cold War on terror, where the U.S. is always going to be involved now in low-intensity conflicts around the world and has asserted that the nation state doesn't really exist anymore when it comes to matters of American national security. We'll go anywhere we need. It's not just that Obama is saying that the U.S. has a right to do this, which many nations disagree with, but saying it's right to do so. And that's what I think has changed the game. These used to be things that were considered sort of dirty public secrets about the way the U.S. did its operations. Under President Obama, it's sort of becoming an official policy, and they're actually trying to argue that it's legal, right, and justifiable.
There is a moment where you're interviewing Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, where you allude to these raids happening outside places where we've declared war, and an aide off camera says we can't acknowledge any of this has ever happened.
Right. I mean, what was sort of funny, and I mean, I give Ron Wyden credit because he really is one of a handful of senators and pretty much the only Democrat in the Senate that has raised serious objections to any of these policies. Most of the people speaking out publicly in the Congress about President Obama's counterterrorism policy are Republicans, in many cases Tea Party Republicans like Rand Paul and Justin Amash and others. So Wyden, when we went to interview him, he's on the Intelligence Committee. He's been there since 9/11. We had to have a lawyer from, you know, the committee sitting off to the side. And the idea with the lawyer was just going to be if Wyden needed to consult about a certain thing. But what we found as we were interviewing Wyden is that almost every question we asked required an intervention from this lawyer. And I felt kind of bad for Wyden because I think he actually was struggling to figure out, am I allowed to answer this or not? Am I going to violate my secondary oath to the Intelligence Committee on this? And so you see this situation that even someone in Congress who feels that the American people have a right to know, for instance, how an American ends up on a kill list and what standards the president uses to determine if it's lawful to kill them, he's struggling to figure out how to answer that question. And as you see in your film, he really can't answer the question. He says, I can't tell you that.
We're getting some questions from listeners. Charlie in Ossining, New York, what's your question for the filmmakers behind Dirty Wars?
I have two questions, actually. One is, in the film, I believe you mentioned that by the way, I just want to say I thought the film was incredible, and I hope it continues to play, but I have no idea if it's still out there. You say that the kill list is expanding as the killings continue. I believe that's asserted in the film, and I'm just sort of wondering how you know that. And then the other question I had was, JSOC itself, I believe, you said that it reports directly to the president, and it's actually not part of the Pentagon. And so I'm wondering if that means that it's actually not bound by the Geneva Conventions on War.
Thanks for your question, Charlie. I mean,
as to the first question about the kill list, we know that for a number of reasons, one of which is from talking to other sources that wouldn't necessarily go on record, and from talking to people who are involved with the drone program. I did a story recently for this new media outlet that Glenn Greenwald and I created called The Intercept, where two of the sources for our story were people that were central players in the targeted killing program with drones. And the sheer volume of individuals that are on that list now is shocking in some of these countries. And sources like that will walk you through it. And it's not that these people are actively being hunted. It's that if their SIM card pops up on the radar or a computer that they're known to be using, you know, flashes green on the screen, then they can go and take them out. But one of the things that's happened as a result of relying on metadata versus human intelligence is that it makes it possible to have an almost infinite list of potential suspects to try to target and take down. So it's not just that the White House has this voracious appetite to kill people. It's that technology has made it possible to, and it's a very flawed, fallible technology, but to sort of predict who they should take out. As to the second part of the question, you know, the Joint Special Operations Command is part of the Pentagon. We don't say that it's not part of the Pentagon. What we said is that it doesn't report through the conventional chain of command and has a more streamlined relationship with the White House. We couldn't get into this in the film, but when President Obama really started to believe that JSOC was his best weapon, had very little to do with what the so-called war on terror. It was when Somali pirates took the Maersk Alabama, which is now the subject of the film Captain Phillips, and it was actually a JSOC team, including some of the individuals who would go on to be involved with the Osama bin Laden raid, that were deployed to take down those Somali pirates. And Obama spoke directly to the tactical commanders on the ground and went straight to them. So the by statute, the Joint Special Operations Command is technically part of the military. In reality, it operates essentially as a small private army within the broader army that the president has at his disposal to use in discrete operations or operations that they don't want the public to know about. And often JSOC operates under Title 50 of the U.S. Code, which is actually traditionally the realm of the CIA. It's an intelligence operation. The bin Laden raid was run under Title 50. JSOC can do covert actions, which often is misreported as only the CIA being able to do it. This is a military unit that is allowed under U.S. law to do covert actions that can be denied by the United States.
Jeremy, you mentioned you recently launched a magazine called The Intercept with Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian journalist most well-known for breaking the story with Edward Snowden's data about the NSA. Tell us about your hopes for that project.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Glenn was at The Guardian. I was at The Nation magazine. Laura Poitras is a great Academy Award-nominated documentary filmmaker. And the three of us had been discussing for some time creating a new news organization. And it wasn't because we didn't like the places we were working or the outlets we were working with. We just felt that there needed to be a more streamlined mechanism for getting these stories out, particularly when you have a whistleblower like Edward Snowden or other sources that we have. You know, you can get caught up in feeling like it takes forever to get stories out. But also, we wanted to build a media outlet that took an inherently adversarial posture toward the state, toward the government's violations of the First and Fourth Amendments to the Constitution, the idea of a free press and the idea of the rights of privacy of Americans, and also the potential for blowback created by a foreign policy that is killing a tremendous number of innocent people. And as we were discussing building that, out of the blue, Glenn received an email from Pierre Omidyar, who is the founder of eBay. To make a long story short, we discussed our idea with Pierre, and he had already had a vision. He was considering buying the Washington Post. He decided not to do that because he wanted to build his own news organization. So we teamed up with Pierre, and The Intercept is the first digital magazine that we've launched under the banner of First Look Media, which is Pierre's new company.
And Rick Rowley, you mentioned you've made a number of films about warfare, about the effects of war. What's it been like to watch the reception to Dirty Wars?
It's been absolutely unbelievable. I mean, when I think back to 3 years ago when Jeremy and I started filming in Afghanistan, or is it 4 years ago now, because it's been a year since the film came out, you know, we knocked on the door of that compound in the village in Gardez. We were the first Americans that this family had seen since the troops who kicked their door in and killed half their family. And yet they invited us in, two guys with beards in our 30s who looked probably a lot like their killers, and sat down and they shared with us this most painful story of their lifetime. And they did it because we made this tacit promise that journalists always make, that we're going to do everything in our power to bring their story back and to share it with people where we're from. And it's a promise that you break all the time. You know, your story gets cut by an editor, it gets ignored, it gets drowned out by the noise of everything else going on. And so, you know, I mean, you live kind of in fear that you're gonna have lied to these families. And just the, you know, when the film, from the film's premiere to its release in the summer here in New York to now this nomination, it's just, it's amazing to have, to be able to have kept our promise with all these people who risked their lives to talk to us. I mean, also, you know, it's easy to get pessimistic when you look at, reach of executive power, you look at all these wars, you look at this system that seems to be spiraling out of control. I mean, one thing that sort of keeps me going and keeps me optimistic is that everywhere we worked in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia, people risked their lives to help this story be told because they believed so deeply in the power of their story and they believed in the American people and an American audience. To them, if an American audience could see what was being done in their name but without their consent, it mattered and it would change something. And so, you know, we refused then to be more cynical about our own country than the families who'd lost their loved ones and risked their lives to talk to us. So anyway, it's amazing to see the film and these stories, the story of the family in Gardez, the story of the missile strike in El Majal in Yemen, to see them, you know, circulate in American culture.
Rick Rowley is a videographer and filmmaker. Jeremy Scahill is an investigative journalist. Their film is called Dirty Wars. It's nominated for an Oscar in the feature documentary category this year. Congratulations on your nomination, and thank you for joining us on WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
And I am Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. We're continuing our Oscar-nominated documentary series now with The Act of Killing. And I don't know if any of you have seen it. It is a most impactful, very powerful film. And it is a film about one of the worst political mass killings of the 20th century. We've been speaking to all of the directors of the Oscar-nominated documentaries this week, and today we are going to speak now with another of those. But if you have seen The Act of Killing, we would like to have you call in so that you can speak with the filmmaker. Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Right now we are joined by that filmmaker, Joshua Oppenheimer, and we congratulate him for his Oscar nomination for The Act of Killing.
Thank you so much.
So let's begin with a very quick history lesson. And feel free if you want to chime in here, because you are so intimately familiar with it, having made this brilliant film. In the mid-1960s, Indonesia's government was overthrown in a military coup. Anyone who opposed the militants was accused of being a communist and killed, which resulted in a mass purging. And you say in the movie about 1 million people were murdered by paramilitaries and gangsters. Josh, how did this story catch your attention?
Well, I was in Indonesia for the first time in 2001 to 2002 to help a group of oil palm plantation workers make a documentary documenting and dramatizing their struggle to organize a plantation workers' union in the aftermath of the Suharto regime, under which unions were illegal. And it turned out they were afraid to organize a union, which they desperately needed. They needed a union because they were on a Belgian oil palm plantation company that was making women workers spray a herbicide, a weed killer, with no protective clothing, and the mist was getting into their lungs and into their bloodstreams, dissolving their liver tissue and killing them in their 40s. But every time they would even go to deliver a petition or protest, this Belgian company would hire the paramilitary group Pancasila Youth, which you see in the film, to threaten or actually attack the workers. So, and it turned out beyond that, their parents and grandparents, the plantation workers' parents and grandparents, had been in a strong plantation workers' union until 1965, had been accused of being potential communist sympathizers simply for being in the union, and had been killed. And that was my first experience of both Indonesia and the genocide.
We often look at these types of events through the eyes of survivors or historians, but you quite brilliantly focus on the perspective of the killers. And you made a deal with them to collaborate on the making of this film. Tell us about that decision and how you came to that agreement.
Well, it began, it evolved organically. After we made this film about the plantation workers, they said, come back immediately and let's make another film together about why we are afraid, about what it's like for us to live with aging death squad leaders all around us still in positions of power. And with, therefore living with the threat that they could do this again to us at any time if we step out of line. I went back straight away in early 2003. And the army, which is stationed in every village in Indonesia, found out what we were doing and would no longer let the survivors participate in the film. So the survivors themselves said, okay, before you quit, before you give up, try and film the perpetrators. Well, when I did that, which I was a little afraid to do at first, I found to my horror that all of them were boastful. All of them would recount openly the grisly details of the massacres with smiles on their faces in front of their families, even their little grandchildren. They would invite me to the places where they killed, launch into sort of spontaneous demonstrations of how they killed. When the survivors and the human rights community saw this material, they said, you're onto something so important. Keep filming the perpetrators, because any Indonesian or anyone anywhere in the world who sees this will be forced to acknowledge finally the rotten heart of this whole present-day regime of fear. And in that, it's important to emphasize that The Act of Killing really is a film about today and how trauma operates today.
And in fact, when you help them recreate the execution scenes in different styles, at one point it looks very Western. At another point it looks very fantasy-like. Is that why you chose the different styles? Because you wanted us to understand that this is as much a film about today as it is about any other point in time?
Well, it's true that the different styles, I think, the different genres that the perpetrators choose to use, they embody how the perpetrators see themselves today. But what happened was, after the survivors and the human rights community told me to film with the perpetrators, I filmed every perpetrator I could find, moving my way from the countryside to the city for 2 years. Anwar Kongo, the main character in the film, was the 41st I met. He was in the city of Medan in North Sumatra. And there it turned out the army recruited its killers from the ranks of gangsters who were hanging out in movie theaters and had a real love for Hollywood movies. And as the movie theater gangsters, which is what they called themselves, started proposing their ideas of reenactments, they started proposing that they stylize what they these dramatizations in stylize them after their favorite Hollywood genres. So they started to propose gangster scenes, cowboy scenes, musical numbers. All of those choices came from them. And I felt that reenacting the film in those ways would make visible the stories these men tell themselves to justify their actions, and the lies they tell themselves to justify their actions, and how they've imposed those lies, that is to say, the victor's history in all of its manifestations on that whole society.
We have a bunch of calls, people who've seen the film. I'm going to just take one of the calls rather randomly. Let's take Josh. You're Josh. Let's take Jason in Suffern. The comments, I mean, I'm just looking at written comments that the callers have made, transcribed by our screeners, and I'm moved. Let's take Jason's call. Jason, you're on with the filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you very much for, I guess, taking my call. Bit of a long-time listener in recent months. Anyways, Josh, I just want to thank you very much for making the film. I actually watched it this past weekend, and I was overall just shocked, if anything, based on the cultural differences. Just watching all the older, I guess, movie theater gangsters, as you called them, just, you know, discussing all this with their families. I think one of the most shocking things, actually, was the large family gathered in, like, a living room, and, you know, a grandpa was being threatened, and the kids were just bawling their eyes out, and I was sitting there watching it. And my thought was, wow, those kids would be totally traumatized and probably are somewhat traumatized. And if something like that happened over here, people would be up in arms. I mean, would you have anything to say, I guess, about that aspect? Or?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you for your kind words. The kids, actually, that scene that you're referring to, it's a scene where we see the paramilitary leaders and former executioners holding an audition in Herman Koto's house. Herman is one of the gangsters in the film, and they're actually auditioning children for their ability to cry. So child actors in this country, too, are called upon to cry and audition for their ability to cry. I think, in fact, that in the film, because of the way that all of the adult perpetrators are in sort of denial of the moral meaning of what they've done, it appears that the kids are the only ones who really feel, who really understand what these events mean, and so we assume they must be traumatized. I actually think the kids are the only ones who don't understand what really happened, and I think all of them are, just as child actors do everywhere in the world, drawing on private pain in order to be able to cry on cue. I think the kids were all okay, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And a lot of people see the film or tell me they're afraid to see the film because they hear victims are playing in reenactments and kids are traumatized and it's extremely graphically violent. I think none of those things are true. I think it's emotionally impactful, not viscerally impactful. And of course, everyone in the reenactment is perpetrators and their immediate families. And the kids, I think, are all actually selected for their ability to cry as good child actors.
Let's take another call. Sarah is in Brooklyn. Sarah, you are on with Josh Oppenheimer. Are you with us, Sarah? We lost Sarah. I do have a reenactment. We have we have Sarah. Go ahead, Sarah. I'd rather hear from I have so many clips of the film I'd love to play as well, but I always love to hear from our callers. So, Sarah, if you've seen the film, go right ahead.
Yes, I am. Hi.
Turn off the radio because I hate nothing more than to hear my own voice.
I am here.
Can you turn down your radio?
I have so many clips of the film. Sure, it's off.
Okay, wonderful. Go ahead. You're so lucky to be on with Josh Oppenheimer. I understand
you've
seen this film.
Sharing in the congratulations for an amazing film as a human rights activist, I can say how rare it is to capture perpetrators talking about what they've done. I think the part that I was most shocked and puzzled by was the extent to which there is no apology, neither from the perpetrators, but also from today's political leaders, the fact that these quasi-government officials, militia leaders, still seem to be in power, still seem to be supporting what happened, and there seems to be no national sense of coming to terms with the past or a sense that what happened was wrong. And I'm interested to know what is the current take of what happened during this period in Indonesia and what efforts there are for truth-telling and coming to terms with the crimes.
Well, there hasn't been a national apology because the killers have remained in power and because they know that the rest of the world was supporting them at the time of the killings. Now, the act of killing has begun to change that. The act of killing has helped to catalyze a sea change, a transformation in how Indonesia is talking about its past. The film's been screened thousands of times in hundreds of cities across Indonesia. It's available for free online in Indonesia. And it's led ordinary Indonesians to start talking openly about the moral catastrophe of the genocide and the moral catastrophe of the regime that the killers have built and ruled over ever since, for the first time, really without fear. And the same can be said of the Indonesian media. The media finally is talking about the genocide as a genocide, producing in-depth reports about what happened. The government has tried to remain silent, I think hoping that this would go away. But with the recent Academy Award nomination, the government finally spoke out and said, okay, their response was wholly inadequate, but they said this was a crime against humanity, but we will deal with it in our own time. Now, that's an about face for the government, because until now, the government has maintained that the genocide was actually heroic. So it's not a sign of goodwill, but it is a barometer of the change that's happened since the film was first released. And then just 2 days ago, we held a screening on Capitol Hill of the film for lawmakers and their staffers and interested parties in Washington, D.C. And the feeling, the sense is that we're trying with very much the hope that this will open a discussion here in the U.S. too, because we were intimately involved in supporting and participating in this. You know, 50 years is long enough not to – it's too long not to call a genocide a genocide. And we can't have a constructive and ethical relationship with Indonesia going forward unless we acknowledge the crimes of the past and acknowledge our collective responsibility in supporting, participating in, and ultimately ignoring those crimes.
So you are starting to feel, Josh, and I want to thank Sarah. Thank you very, very much for your call and for your shout out to Josh and your support of his work. Are you feeling that the film is having a direct impact in Indonesia?
Oh, yeah, beyond what we ever could have hoped for. The film... The editor of Indonesia's leading news publication called me after seeing the film. He said, "Josh, there will be a time. There was a time before the act of killing. Now there will be a time after the act of killing." And I've been censoring stories about this genocide ever since I've been in this job. He said, "I won't do it anymore because your film shows me that I don't want to grow old as a perpetrator."
Excellent, excellent. The greatest praise that you could receive, truly. Let's take another call. I'm going to take, the board is lit up, which really tells you the response that you've had. And that, you know, we can just randomly pick Carl in Manhattan, who it seems was a photojournalist. Is that correct, Carl?
Yes, I was a photojournalist then. And I had been invited by a friend whose father had been the last great Raja in Bali. And after doing that, I went to Surabaya, which is at the eastern end of Java, and we were having dinner, a friend and I, and at the end of the block, you heard some machine guns go off, and no one moved a muscle, just kept on eating. And then I wanted to visit a friend of mine who lived in the Central Highlands, in the old capital, and he implored me, "Please, please do not come. They may think you're a Russian, and if I'm seen with you, it'll be dangerous for me."
Well, I think
and he also told me that the Solo River was very bloody because when people would be killed and hacked, they were just dumped into the river.
Mm. I think what you're speaking to, it's powerful. These are powerful memories of what it is like to live in a regime of total fear. And I think there's just two thoughts I have about it. One is that when you live in a one of the signs of state terror being at its most effective is when I think people don't even dare to think about the things that worry them and don't even dare to remember that they're afraid. People just become habituated to silencing themselves, to censoring themselves. They know what not to talk about. The other thought that occurred to me was that the body choked Solo River in Central Java mm-hmm. was actually reported in the U.S. news in 1965, but as good news. New York Times and Time magazine ran headlines, "The West's Best News for Years," and "A Gleam of Light in Asia," over stories of the Solo River running red with blood, choked with bodies, and hundreds of thousands of people being killed. When people say, "How come we've never heard of this?" one of the key reasons is that how do you remember one of the biggest massacres in human history when it's reported or told to you as good news?
Yeah. You know, an Oscar is a wonderful thing, but there are things far more important than winning an award. I have the temerity to say to you on your eve of hoping to win one. But, you know, this film is very difficult to watch, and yet I think people need to have the courage to watch it. Make your case to our listeners, even though so many clearly have seen it, for why they should force themselves, if I may use that term, to sit through it.
Well, I would say that as I said earlier, I think some of you may be hesitating to watch it because you've heard it's graphically violent or there's victims playing in the reenactments. Those things are not true. The film is emotionally impactful.
Emotionally, yes.
It asks you to become close to people who have committed atrocities through, in fact, my closeness to them. Mm-hmm. So if you're not horrified hearing my voice, think of me as your guide, taking you close to these men, and know that the function of art, ultimately, I hope, is to invite us, seduce us, bring us into contact with the most painful but also important aspects of who we are. And I hope if you watch The Act of Killing, that will be your experience.
That is wonderful. Well, that is really, really a wonderful recommendation. And I do hope, even though I sort of poo-pooed the Oscar, I do wish you the best of luck in winning it.
Well, if we win an Oscar, it will certainly be
right.
A really important moment Indonesia, for the survivors, for the human rights community,
and
help that country
attention.
Move. Yeah, absolutely. It'll force the government to respond more constructively and embolden Indonesians to finally hold their leaders to account for their crimes.
And congratulations to you in your courage for making this film. This is Joshua Oppenheimer. He is the director of the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Act of Killing. Thanks, Josh, and good luck.
Thank you.